Good morning, afternoon, and evening to everyone, wherever you are.
Good morning.
Morning. My name is Alan Toussaint, Community Liaison Officer for the Dominica Geothermal Development Company. Let me welcome everyone to the Dominica Geothermal Development Company Limited National Consultation on the ESIE studies for the Dominica Geothermal Development Project. Just a few housekeeping matters. Please ensure that your mic is muted during the presentation. Please reserve your questions for after each segment of the presentation. Please use the raise hand feature to ask a question. Before we begin, I'll introduce the members of the various teams participating in this consultation. From the Dominica Geothermal Development Company, the DGC, we have Mr. Fred John, Managing Director, Ms. Lynn Fontenelle, Safeguards and Administration Manager, Mr. Rawlings Rooney, Electrical Engineer, Mrs. Rita Edmonds, Human Resource and Finance Manager, Mr. Dalton Iloa, Mechanical Engineer, Ms. Shaisha Birmingham, Project Assistant and Host of the Consultation, Mr. Gary Shillingford, Site and Office Attendant. Can you just bear with me a minute? I'm just trying to get them. Okay, we're back on. Also from the GDC, we have Mr. Xavier Collet, who is the environmental consultant for the DGDC. From the environmental resource management, we have Herbert Perella, who is a project manager, and we have Sonia Cuesta, who is a social specialist. From Eclipse Inc., we have Marie Josie Edwards. Just some brief information about EMR and Eclipse Inc. EMR are the consultants who prepared the addendum to the project environmental, social, and assessment impact assessment. As some of you may already know, the original ESIA was done by the consulting firm Jacobs from New Zealand in 2018. However, some adjustments were made to the scope of the project, and so an addendum to the project ESIA was necessary. Eclipse Inc. is represented by Marie-Josée Edwards, and is a consulting firm who prepared the ESIA for the construction of an operation of the geothermal reinjection well and RV1 and pipeline. Please remind you that all the ESIA documents are available on our website at www.geodominica.dm/ESIA. Now for the main program. This consultation will be done in two parts. The first part will be a geothermal project update presented by the Managing Director, Mr. Fred John. This update will give us an idea of how far we've come since the project began, where we are to date, and where we plan to go. After the project update segment, Mr. John will take questions pertaining to the project update. The second and main part of the consultation will be the presentation of the addendum to the ESIA by the consulting firm, Environmental Resources Management, ERM. After this segment, we'll also have a question and answer session. Participants, please be advised that this consultation is being recorded, and we ask everyone to be respectful. as we intend to have a productive consultation with you. We will now call on the Managing Director, Mr. John, who will begin with the project update.
Okay, good morning, everyone. Thank you for joining us this morning. Just want to give us 1 second, please. Okay, just want to pay a special welcome to our partners. Give us 1 second, we're having some audio feedback issues. Okay, just testing. Okay, I think we're okay now. Okay, so special welcome to our partners in this venture. I notice we have Dominic here, so welcome. This first section is really going to be very brief, hoping for maybe 10-15 minutes based on the questions you have, because most of this presentation time we want to save for ERM and Eclipse to discuss the main subject matter today. I'm going to just share my screen because we prepared a few slides for you. I want to just make sure you can see the slides. Okay. Okay, so one of the things we've done over the years, this project has been going on for quite a while now, but we wanted to just quickly share with you the extent of engagement that we have undertaken. This slide just shows the recent past, but it's really something we've paid close attention to in making sure the community understands what this project is about and how it impacts them, and we've taken ideas from the community. So without going through all of this, I want to just say that we really have tried to reach out to the community on this project, and if there's any group who is not here who would like us to engage with them directly, please let us know and we will arrange some time with you. As Alan mentioned, and it's worth reiterating that today we are talking about an addendum to the ESIA. The original document was prepared by Jacobs before Hurricane Maria. It was updated in 2018 after Hurricane Maria, to make sure the changes in the environment as well as the social circumstances of the community were reflected. And today, we are here to present a further update on this document. Due to the fact that 3 years have elapsed, as well as the project has changed in several ways. And we'll talk about that in a second. So a new ESIA was required. The old one is still valid, but this addendum is to capture what has changed. And we're thankful to have had with us the Environmental Resources Management Group, ERM, as well as Dominica's own Eclipse. And not to forget, we were supported quite well on this by Mr. Xavier Cole, who is on the phone today. So let's spend a few minutes talking about the project as a whole. Some of you may be new to this project, so forgive me if I go back just a little bit to make sure everyone understands why we're doing this. So if you look at the left side of this presentation, it basically reinforces the fact that fundamentally the project has not changed. Our objective is to contribute to cheaper electricity for the country. And in doing so, or while doing so, help reduce the dependence of Dominica on imported fossil fuels for generation of electricity. In the near term, that directly impacts homes and businesses. In the longer term, based on the size of the resource and the direction that the government and other decision makers make, extend that impact beyond just homes and businesses. In doing so, we have taken particular care to do it the right way. And the right way has many implications, but it means not taking shortcuts. It means considering the community and the environment in everything that we do and ensuring that everything is done, all of the planning is done with the highest levels of safety in mind. So that's very important, because as we go through this presentation, as we go through the ESIA addendum, you will see how thorough, hopefully, the work has been. And this is because we are trying to do this right. Also want to just point out for those of you who are new to the project, that we currently have 5 geothermal wells drilled in the Rosa Valley. So this is really just a continuation of work that has been going on and been going on quite successfully. Okay, so in terms of what has changed, the first is a fairly strategic point, which is the plan for developing the resource has been updated. It has been refreshed. The most immediate step is the fact that we were planning to do a 7-megawatt plant, and we have, based on the results of our testing and assessing the needs of the country and the funding options available to us, it made sense to increase that to 10 megawatts. So that's pretty significant, and that drives a lot of the change in the ESIA that you're going to see. Another key approach tweak, I mean, it has always been the intent, but we have really we've really taken it to another level, is making sure that the domestic and potential export components of this whole geothermal development are more tightly linked. Because at the end of the day, they are both targeted to use the same resource, and there's a lot of synergy that can be had by doing those two projects together as far as possible. Domestic priority, but understanding that whatever you do for the domestic, try to leverage it for the export. So that has very real implications in how we go about executing a project. One of the other things that has changed is the whole reinjection strategy. Again, if you're new to geothermal, the approach is you extract it from the ground, use it, and the cooled fluids get reinjected back into the reservoir. The prior design had this happening almost 4 kilometers away from the production site, and that presented many technical challenges, which sort of came to the fore when we went to market to get an EPC contractor for this. So we have redesigned the reinjection concept, and we are now settled on a new reinjection well, which is just 1 kilometer away from the plant. And talking of wells, based on the economic considerations, we have decided to invest in an additional production well, which will be drilled at the same time as the reinjection well. So big picture, these are the things which have changed, and all of these are driving the changes that we are here to discuss today. It's also noteworthy to point out that we have made a strategic decision to utilize the most environmentally friendly technology. There are different ways to generate geothermal power, but we have selected the one which is hands down the most environmentally friendly one. It's called binary plant. Some of the really great things about that, first of all, it's more expensive than the alternatives, but it's near zero emissions because it's a closed loop system, and it also helps sustain the life of your reservoir. In so really and truly, what comes out goes right back in. Another
Dalton City, he was here.
Mm-hmm. Another simple but important part of this technology is the fact that, and the way we're doing it, we're using air-cooled condensers. So there is no need to extract large amounts of water or fresh water to cool the system. There are no huge cooling towers like you see in power plants around the world. And there is no huge steam plume in the environment. Because there's, again, it's all cooled by air. Fans are cooling the liquids before they get reinjected. So just wanted to point that out because it's one of the demonstrations of how we've gone about doing this, keeping the environment in mind. Now, this last point is not yet relevant to today's session, but it's worth putting out there. Because it is part of what's driving the evolution of the project. And that is with a 10 megawatt plant, with an increase to a 10 megawatt plant, we have also worked with our partners to do something which needed to get done anyway. And that is to build a transmission network capable of moving all of that power from the Roseau Valley to the load centers on the West Coast and the North. And to do so efficiently and also keep in mind the fact that the system, the country is growing and the system will be required to carry more than 10 megawatts in the future. And of course, this is Dominica resilience is extremely important based on the hazards that we face. So that network is also going to keep that in mind. So we won't be talking about that today, but I'm putting it out there as something that is happening as part of this project, and we will be having sessions like this focused just on the transmission line. And it's very important to note that this transmission network is being done with very, very close collaboration with Domlec, and we're pleased for that and thankful for that collaboration. Okay, so very quickly, giving you an idea of on the ground what this project looks like. So you're looking at a shot of the Loda area. For those of you who know Loda, this is sort of the entrance. If you can see my cursor, this is the entrance of the village. This green line coming down, yeah? So existing village, and if you were to turn over to the right here, this would take you, this is the road to the Domlec Power Station, Domlec Balancing Tank, and off to Tito Gorge. So the power plant itself is over here in this green shaded area. This blue line represents the reinjection line that we just spoke about 1 kilometer long. And this area, which is bounded in red, represents the site for the reinjection well. Over here to the extreme right, this is the backup production well that we said we'll be drilling at the same time the equipment is Dominica to drill the reinjection well. So that's the footprint of it. It's all contained in Loda, though the resource itself is obviously beyond Loda itself. In terms of benefits, one of the questions we get most often when we go to the communities and discuss this is what's in this for us? Why should we be doing this? We've already spoken about the obvious one, which is lower cost of electricity for homes and businesses in Dominica. We've also mentioned the fact that this is good for the environment and good for the economy in terms of helping to displace diesel. And the future phase, which I said is a key part of this project, will generate direct income for the government and people of Dominica. So that's at a overall, those are the benefits you can expect from the project. On a more local level, we are already seeing I mean, the obvious employment opportunities which come with such a large project, as well as a focused contribution to developing the communities that we operate in. And for that, we have an entire safeguards team focused on the community, and they're engaged with the different village improvement committees and councils as appropriate. And just a quick, in terms of what do you expect next from the project? Land acquisition is in process. It has taken a little longer than any of us would want, but it's happening. And then all of the other things that go with bringing this project together, the project financing, the legal and commercial agreements, selecting an EPC contractor, all of those are in progress. So it's a very intense period of work right now. On the ground, the first thing you should see is the drilling of two wells. Well, actually, before the drilling, civil works to prepare for the drilling of two wells. And that civil works, those of you in the valley should see some evidence of that within maybe 2 months. And once at least one of those wells is drilled, we will mobilize the EPC contractor and actually start constructing the plant. And by the way, the drilling of these wells is really about a 40-day exercise once the preparation work is done. So it's not a very long exercise. And of course, the new transmission network, as I said, that work is going on in the background. So there'll be a lot of engineering and environmental studies associated with that as well. So that's really the basic facts I wanted to share with you. And I think now we take a few questions on this. Again, the idea here is to save most of this presentation time for ERM and Eclipse. So I will answer as many of those as I can now, but we will record every one of them and provide answers if it's a more complex topic or if we just have a really large volume of questions. Okay, so we welcome any questions you have right now on the project itself.
Okay. Question.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. What sort of legislative framework is the government putting in place to oversee the environmental concerns that may result from the operation of the geothermal plant once it's been implemented? From what I've seen at other sites where EIAs have been done, after a period of time, example, the Layo River, there's pollution going on out there, and there is no active government enforcement, or implementation of the law. So I want to know what kind of legislative framework, that the government is putting in place, to deal with any impacts from the operation of the geothermal plant, seeing that it's a new facility that's going on in the country.
Okay. The government aspect of this, I will defer for later, but I can tell you what the project has to do, as in must do, for it to operate successfully, which is the entire environmental and social impact assessment that's already exist and is being updated right now comes with a package of monitoring measures. Everything from noise, sound, vibrations, everything that goes with safe operation, and not just for the environment, but also for the people, the social impact on the people as well. Those are monitored continuously and reported on. And keep in mind that this project is financed by international don't, well, banks, for most part, as well as some very large consortium partners we have, who have no choice but to respect the strictest standards. So basically, in a nutshell, if this project does not comply with the requirements that are in the ESIA and all of the documents that fall out of the ESIA, it gets shut down.
Okay, and so my next question, in the 36 consultations you have had, what sort of concerns that may have arisen from the public, and what adjustments you guys have made to remediate those concerns moving forward?
Okay. I'm going to try to give you maybe the top three, just top of mind. One, probably the biggest one is water. Number two, not in sequence, but just water is a big one. Is this going to affect our water supply? Is this going to pollute our water supply? Is this going to affect our hot springs? Water is a big one. Safety, is this safe? Is this, I mean, should we be afraid? We live in the valley. Is this going to cause explosions? Is this, I mean, right? So safety is another really big one. And the third one has been the benefit. Why are we doing this? Is this actually worth it? We have, the point of this consultations really and truly is to listen to those concerns and dig into them and make adjustments as required. I can give you a real example in the last 6 months where we did that. In Loda, in locating the reinjection well, we had several meetings about that, and the community came back with concerns about water in the first proposed location, as well as vibrations. And we went back to the consultants, the designers, and we made adjustments, and then went back to the committee and showed them how we had changed the proposed location to one which reduced the risks that they were concerned about. And we didn't just change the location, we actually changed the specifications of the technical specifications that went into the tender documents for drilling. So in drilling, you can tweak multiple parameters, vibration speed, the load. I mean, there's a lot of stuff you can do. So all of that went in to minimize vibrations in the area during the drilling operation, and to move to locations where there would be lower impact on the water in case of flooding, the water system in case of flooding and the like. So we take those consultations very seriously.
And sorry about that. My last question. Before I go, just want to ask. So one of the things I saw in the 7 kilowatt initial plant, it was estimated to operate for what, 25 years? And I'm asking, is that the same amount of time that the 100 kilowatt plant is expected to last? And how, you said it's going to be cheaper. Is there any idea of how much money has been spent on the geothermal exploration? How much is going to be spent on the construction of the geothermal plant? And basically, I know geothermal has cost of operation and maintenance. How is that going to factor in the pricing of electricity so that you can recover your investment costs plus make a profit in addition to all the other costs that's going on? How is that going to affect the price of geothermal as compared to what we see in electricity is going for today?
Okay. There's several questions in there. So this has been going on. By going on, I mean actively developing this project for over a decade, as I think many people know, which is actually not unusual for geothermal, especially if you are trying to not make expensive mistakes. One of the greatest risk areas and cost areas of geothermal is getting the wells done and getting them done correctly, so you don't have to go back and drill additional wells. So the government of Dominica, long before I was part of this project, they made that investment with the help of many donors. And they succeeded in drilling 3 test wells, plus 1 production well and 1 reinjection well. All of this investment, most of this was funded with grant funds, as I said, from friendly governments and organizations. I would think well over $20 million was spent on that development. The government itself obviously has invested in terms of the land and setting up the GDC and operating the GDC. And going forward, the major capital expenditure to build up this first plant, the numbers are not yet in, so we're going to have to wait a few months for that. But that's going to be funded by concessional financing for most part. So it won't be the interest rates will be much better than what you'd get from a commercial bank. All of this goes into the price of that we're able to sell the power to Domlec, which I think gets to your question as to the cost of this electricity. So the financial models obviously are done before you make such investments. You do a financial model and you make sure this is going to be viable. So the financial models have been done. The good news is, based on where we are now in negotiations, the cost of finance is better than what we projected. The cost of the actual construction is probably right about what's in the model. So we are on track to deliver what we sort of promised in terms of the wholesale price to Domlec. Because Domlec is the one who has to take this power from Loda and get it to your homes and businesses. There was a part of your question as to sort of affordability, I think. This really comes down to, there are many components that go into the final price of power to you. But foundational to all of that is how much it costs to generate it. And based on the numbers we have now and where we are, we don't expect any major changes between now and when we close all of those deals. We should be significantly cheaper on generation cost than diesel, which again, Domlec generates power from multiple sources. Diesel is just one of them, but it's a very significant one. So we are on track to deliver to Domlec power, which is significantly cheaper than what it costs to generate it from diesel. Actual numbers don't have those yet, but we can assure you that it will be much cheaper than what it costs to do with diesel.
Sorry, I said I was going to ask the last question, but you mentioned something that spurred me to ask, and I promise that's the last one. So you just mentioned that geothermal may be cheaper than use of diesel, which I'm probably not going to agree with. However, in the development of any new energy, it is prudent to compare it to other sources of renewable energy. So how does that compare? And did you guys do any cost analysis for solar, wind, and other sources of energy that may have been cheaper and faster to develop instead of, you know, you said we've been working on this for a decade already, and like every year it goes by, there is cost and there is inflation. I mean, 10 years is a lot of time. Have we looked at other alternative sources of energy and did any cost comparison to geothermal?
Again, the answer is obviously yes. But I'm going to answer this quickly because I know this will be taking quite a bit of time from the presentation, but, absolutely, no question about it. Here is what you need to understand with this project and geothermal in general. The biggest difference between geothermal and the others you mentioned is that it's a 24/7 operation. It is base load. When you turn on the turbines, they do not go off until you need to maintain them. So you do not need to store the power and you are independent of weather. So time to develop a geothermal project, yes, the upfront time is significant. That's not a secret. the capital cost initially is also high, which is why it takes so long, because before you go sink that money in, you've got to do all of the studies and it takes a while. But once you have established the resource, and here is why Dominica is blessed, in that we have an extremely good resource technically in the Rosa Valley. It's high pressure, high temperature, high permeability, and it's not extremely deep. So you don't need to, you don't even need to pump it out. It comes out under its own pressure. So that resource we have here comfortably beats any of the alternatives out there. And again, it doesn't mean that the shots not on the alternative. It just means that if you're trying to displace diesel at a national level, we are extremely fortunate to be able to do it with geothermal. Okay. Now I'm going to probably just do 5 more minutes of questions, but let's have someone else, please.
Yes, good morning. I know there are similar projects in other parts of the Caribbean, St. Kitts and Nevis, for example. Mm-hmm. Are there any lessons that have come out of those that you have incorporated in this project?
I think in many cases we are actually ahead of them. I really think so. Simply because we've been at this for a while, we have the test wells drilled. So I think it's, in many cases, it's the other way around. Yeah. Did that answer your question, or there was some other aspect to it you wanted to discuss?
Yeah, I thought Nevis is really quite advanced. Is at production stage, so that might be not be the case, but I thought they were ahead of us.
No, I think we are, and the resource we have, I think, and we've been advised by all of the advisors that we are one of the best in the world in terms of the resource we have as well. So that's why the export part of this is so unique and so exciting, because the investments we are making now, all of the studies I mentioned over the last 10 years, they are really not just about a 10 megawatt plant for Dominica. They are about Dominica being an exporter of energy as well. So this is very, very exciting for the country. Any other questions?
Good morning. Morning, can you hear me?
Not very well.
Okay, is that any better?
Yes.
Yeah, one of my concerns is, you know, any issues that may be related to the Roseau Valley and the event of any sort of mistakes or emergencies. I'm wondering whether you guys have an emergency plan already in place. And I'm wondering, in light of the fact that, you know, I listened to the conversation between Prime Minister and the Ambassador recently, where the Ambassador seemed to acknowledge that concerns raised by certain citizens with regard to the planned digging of a production well and then extending pipelines down to the Watkins Glen area. When these concerns were raised, he said that, you know, y'all went back to the experts and got a review done, and the result was that plans were changed. So, in light of that fact that, you know, these concerns raised seem to have been justified, will there be an effort to include concerned citizens in discussions with regard to the progress of the project? And how can you allay our fears in relation to the possibilities of accidents and the responses that may be in place in the event that something were to happen? I'm very concerned about the fact that this operation is taking place. I'm no professional, but I'm as a layperson. The fact that this is taking place so high up, and if something were to happen, the rapidity with which disaster can strike is my main concern. So I'd just like you to address that.
Okay. Several parts to this question. Let me just clarify. I think I should probably just clarify the water and wave pipeline question. It wasn't a question, but a statement. The original design of running from Loda to Watonwaven was primarily driven by the fact that we have a well in Watonwaven, an existing well, which could have, well, and Trafalgar, two wells in that area, which could have been used for reinjection. So at the time, the thought was to, and also technically it made sense to reinject in that part of the reservoir. So a lot of factors. But the main reason for abandoning that plan was mostly commercial and reliability of supply. Simply, the terrain is very rough. It's a very rough terrain, and expensive, multiple bridges to be built. So that's really what killed that idea. In terms of something happening in the valley, as a result of the geothermal, we do not want to downplay that at all. I mean, it's a very well proven technology. So we can talk about what that something could be. But the fact is it's a major industrial operation in its own right. And you have to be prepared for contingencies and emergencies. So yes, there are multiple plans, response plans in place, and we can discuss those and get, as we go, actually, I mean, October 2019, I think, was the most recent time we tested our production well in Loda, and we had a full rehearsal for that, including all of the emergency services. So there are plans in place, and those plans are only going to get more detailed and more widespread as we move from where we have been so far in sort of just pure exploration mode to actual commercial operation of a facility in the valley. So I'm not sure where you reside, but when we come to the communities, that's something we talk about all the time, and we are going to do a whole lot more of it now that we are moving to a more serious phase of operation. But let's just go back one step and sort of understand that the best way to deal with an emergency is to prevent it as far as possible. And that's where you design safety into your systems. And again, in the interest of time, we cannot go into all of it, but the way this has been done and the advisors that we have and the scrutiny and the validation that this entire process goes through with international organizations and experts, safety is designed into this and monitoring as well. So, I mean, during the drilling operation, geothermal drilling, obviously, it's a dangerous activity in its own right, but it's a well understood activity, and the process of selecting a drilling contractor is extremely thorough. We are going through it right now. So I can tell you it's an extremely thorough process, and we've done it 5 times so far successfully. So that's an area that we're very comfortable with. Monitoring for any accidents in terms of gases, or that's going to be all over the Rosa Valley. And then of course you have the possibility of a pipeline leaking. But let me just tell you the reinjection pipeline, which is the only one that's of any significant length, 1 kilometer, This is not high pressure, not high temperature. And there are sensors at the plant to shut down the system in the event of even the slightest leak. So it's not a new process by any means. And we are absolutely doing our best to make sure that we do it to the highest standards possible. Okay. I'm going to sort of have to stop here, unfortunately, because we do need to allow ERM and Eclipse to present. But any other additional questions, please send them into us and we will get back to you as soon as possible. And thank you so much for your attention.
Okay, thank you for it. We now invite Mr. Herbert Pereira, the project manager from ERM, to present the addendum to the project environmental, social, and impact assessment. Mr. Pereira, you can go ahead.
Thank you very much, Alan and Fred, for the introduction. My name is Herbert Pereira. I work for ERM. I've been working at ERM for 20 years. Also join us as a social specialist. So we're going to divide our presentation in talking about the environmental impacts, and after that, we're talking about the social impacts.
Okay.
Can you hear me? Sonia, you need to move the screens.
Hold on, let me reshare it again. Sorry about it. Is that working now?
No, you need to put it in screen mode. Yeah, you got it now.
Okay, thank you.
Anybody can see the screen now?
Yes.
Okay, good. Yep. Okay, good morning. As I said before, good morning, everybody, and welcome. Thank you very much for attending this meeting. My name is Herbert Pereira. I'm the project manager with ERM to present the environmental impact assessment that we did. And also I have my colleague, Sonia Cuesta, which is a social specialist. So between us, we're going to present our result for the environmental impact assessment. Sonia, can you move this? I cannot move it from here. Can you, next slide? When we started, the work, to do the environmental impact assessment, one thing to keep in mind that to do an environmental impact assessment is not just static, but it's a process that we have to follow. And there is some guidance that we need to follow. We started this process to develop the supplement to addendum to the SES in November 2020, and we completed our report in February, which is, as Fred mentioned, it was published in the DC website, and also since there is some lenders that had to meet some requirements, they also posted the report in their website. Sonia, can you next slide, please? Now, as I mentioned before, the to develop an environmental impact assessment is not just a static process. It's a static way to do it, but it's a process. Basically, in this slide here, we show the different steps or phases that we have to follow to develop an environmental impact assessment. The first step that we we usually do is called scoping, is that we predict likely interaction between the project and the environment. Since this project has been, you know, developed since 2017, two environmental assessments have been completed. One completed in 2018 by JECOS, and the other one was completed in 2020 by Eclipse. So in all this process, we try to incorporate all comments that are being already presented to the project to incorporate that in this assessment. The next step is the assessment of the environmental impact. And basically at this phase, we execute it, or we produce, execute the evaluated impacts and what mitigations, we can propose. The next step is to produce a report. Well, in this one, we produce a report. The next step is to review the report. And this is what we have right now. We went through the process, and now we have this public meeting to get any comments and any feedback that we get from this presentation or later, we incorporate it in the final report. And that's why is stakeholder engagement is important in all this process. Sonia, next please. Now, as a friend mentioned, this report, this environmental impact assessment is not a complete environmental impact assessment because the project has evolved through time, and there is information already presented in the 2018 JECOS report and also in the CLICS report. So that's why this is a supplemental environmental impact assessment to supplement what was not included because the project had progressed with time for the new design of the project. So basically the two areas, and we conduct a lot of meetings and we expert to figure out what are the gaps. And we figured out what are the gaps between the 2018 report and the 2020 and what we need to cover now. And the two areas, important areas that we figured out that are important to cover in this addendum was the effects to the biological resources and the effects to the social resources. Now, this over here shows the different components of the addendum. We have a project description that describes what is new in this addendum compared with the 2018 and the 2020 with the CLICS. We also went to regulatory legislation requirements, updated that section. As I mentioned before, we updated the baseline assessment specifically for the biological resources. We look at the protected areas, critical habitat assessments, and ecosystem services. For the social size, we look at in detail what has changed for the migration, gender, human rights. Now we didn't have COVID-19 before. Now we have it. So we include that. We include any new information about land acquisition and resettlement. Then the next section is an impact assessment and what proposed mitigation we have. And the last step in this report was that we completed, upgraded the environmental and social management plan and monitoring plans that were included to include how the project had changed with time. This is presented as Appendix B in the environmental impact assessment that I was published. Now, throughout all this process, we have lenders, international lenders included in this process, we have to include the environmental guidance. For example, for the International Inter-American Development Bank, we include their operational policies. For the Caribbean Development Bank, we include the operational policies. For the World Bank, we include guidance for geothermal projects. And for the International Finance Corporation, we include the FEMA standards. All of these, operation policy had to deal with the social and environmental mitigations and impact to the project. So we took all into account in this addendum report. Next, please. Now, this we're talking about the process, you know, how we started in November 2020. We have a report in February 2001. Now, this over here, this slide, I want to talk now about the results of the environmental impact assessment. This slide shows the cover of the report that was published in February 2001, that was published in the DC website and all the websites from the lender's website. Next, please. Now, to do any environmental impact assessment, we had to follow some standardized methodology that is common use throughout the industries. Basically, this slide shows the steps that you take to evaluate impacts and what are the mitigation they have to use. The first step is to predict what could happen are the consequences of the project, what happened to the environment, or what happened to social issues. We look at the impacts, and now we evaluated these impacts. What are the impacts that are important that we need to evaluate and need to mitigate? And we also look at, you know, in consultation with the comments that the project already have. The next step is to go to the mitigation and enhancement, is figure out, okay, if there are any significant impacts, how we can mitigate these impacts. And the last step is, if we cannot mitigate these impacts and there is some residual impacts, are these residual impacts significant? And what else we can do to further mitigate any impacts that are, we call residual impacts? And on the right side, at the bottom right side of the presentation, we have like a classification or rating matrix that we use. The top column we have the receptors, you know, how sensitive are the receptors, and we qualify that in low, medium, and high. And in the left column we have the magnitude impact, and we rate these impacts as you indicate over here in color, but also, you know, the impacts are negligible, minor, moderate, and we have major impacts. And also in some projects, we also have beneficial impact, not just negative impact, but also we can have potentially, we can have positive impacts. Next slide, please. Now, I'm going to talk about as I mentioned before, the two areas that we look at specifically to supplement the existing, two environmental assessment reports that have been done for the project was the biological environment. Next, please. We're talking about here the terrestrial biologists. This is why I give you a summary of what are the existing conditions at the project site or nearby. Dominican contains one of the most extensive and disturbed tropical forests of the Lesser Antilles. Deforestation occurs in the 19th century. A lot of reforestation for agriculture purposes. The vegetation cover at the project site is primarily rainforest, secondary forest that is experienced regrowth for abandoned cropland areas that were not cultivated anymore. And areas that were damaged for Hurricane Maria. And also near the site, there are still some agricultural land and some urban areas that, as you can tell, the project is near some of these villages. The project, as you probably know, the project is in the vicinity of the Montrose Python National Protected Area. It's a wildlife, a World Heritage Site that is protected. And we want to be sure that this project doesn't affect, doesn't produce impact to this protected area. In the previous report and the previous environmental impact assessment, there were a number of threatened and endemic species to the Lesser Antilles that were observed in the study area. This include one frog, four birds, and one lizard. Studies for the EIA have determined that the project area is no critical habitat for the conservation of species, for impacting these species. I just want to point that out, that that is very important. Next, please. Now, as I tell you, you know, we, a part of the environmental impact assessment, we need to, if we know what is there, what is the existing environment, how the project is going to impact some of these resources. Now, when we do an impact analysis, we usually look at the components of the project. We look at constructions, activities, and we look at the operational activities. Now, what are the impacts that we noticed or evaluated during the impact assessment was, what is the impact to the vegetation due to clearance? Direct mortality to fauna due to the vegetation removal or by vehicle collisions? Habitat loss due to construction? Noise disturbance during construction? How that noise can affect wildlife in the area? And also, if you're going to have a lot of light, how does this light affect the fauna in the project area? During operations, there is another set of impacts. Some of them might be similar, some of them are different, but these are the key ones. Direct injury, mortality due to vehicle collisions because of the increased traffic. We can have the fragmentation of habitat and reduction of ecological connectivity. We can have injury due to open geothermal brine ponds. You know, if you have a pond, birds can land in this pond thinking this is a lake and might be injured. We also have increase if this project have a lot of light, you know, noise, light and noise pollution. We have air emission, that can inhibit the vegetation growth. For example, if you have a lot of dust and you cover the vegetation with dust, that inhibited the growth. And as Mr. Fred mentioned, we're talking about what happened if it's a well blow up. How does the blow up can affect the wildlife? How this might affect the vegetation and how this could injure, you know, some fauna in the area. And we also could have, you know, because the project is near to this wildlife conservation site, is there any temporary degradation to the habitat, to this protected area? Now, to the right side on the top, we have, as I show you, the methodology we used to rate the impacts. This is how we rated impacts during construction and operation for vegetation, fauna, and protected areas. So we feel for during construction, the impacts are moderate for construction, and for operation, negligible. For fauna is moderate, and moderate for also operations. And there is, there are going to be some impacts, to the protected areas. You know, we feel that the impact, because the protected areas nearby, is going to have moderate impacts, and during operations it's going to be minor. The next slide, please. This NHI shows, okay, you evaluated, you have these impacts. How would you mitigate these impacts? So we have, again, we have what kind of mitigation measures we recommend during construction and what kind of recommendation we use during operation. So when we have impact, if the impact is moderate, can we lower these impacts? How far we can lower? So these are the measurements that recommend to lower the rating of the impacts. So something that is more reasonable and less impact to the environment. For example, avoid removal of trees and vegetation where possible. I mean, we want to be strict that only to clear areas that are needed for the construction of the plant or the pipeline. If it's possible, maintain vegetation barriers as feasible. One thing that we propose is that areas that have been disturbed, that are disturbed temporarily, need to be revegetated or restored. We native vegetation native to the site. We also have a strict during construction, they have to implement those control measures. Conduct detailed surveys of flora and fauna before constructions to see if you have any protected species in the area that you need to be relocated before the construction start, and implement a rescue, relocate, all these species. in some cases, you know, you can hire, you know, have horns or, you know, to, if it's pieces in the area to be scared to move away from the site before the construction starts. And also we have, you train and educate workers on code of conduct regarding wildlife and incident report. If there's any accidents happen to wildlife, it need to be reported, to the high authorities. Install, you know, traffic signs and speed limits so that it's protected to people and also to wildlife. And implement best management practices, standard practice in Dutch, for noise control. Also minimize, light pollution. Using also best practices in industry, and implement a biodiversity management plan. This is during construction. During operations, again, we, as a friend mentioned, there are strict, management plans and disaster plan that have to be implemented to prevent a well blow up. Design and implement community wildlife education training so they know how to protect the wildlife. And again, implement a biodiversity management plan. From the previous slide, I show you what was the rating before any mitigations are implemented. This table over here shows how we rate impacts after these mitigations are implemented. As you can see, for vegetation, you know, if they implement the measures that we propose, we rate impacts at negligible instead of moderate for both for the construction and operations. For fauna, we rated from moderate, we rated from negligible to minor, and also for the operations. And the protected areas, we feel to implement, as if measure implemented, there is no, it won't be any impact to these protected areas. Next, please. Now, this concludes the terrestrial biodiversity talks. Now, Sonia is going to talk about the social environment. Go ahead, Sonia.
Thank you, Herbert. Hi, everyone. So my name is Sonia Cuesta, and I'll be presenting the social environment components of the addendum. So as part of our report, we've added several components to our analysis, which included gender, worker influx, land acquisition, and cumulative impacts. With regard to gender, this slide presents the existing conditions in Dominica. So the protocol to the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women has not been signed or ratified in Dominica yet. And the Protection Against Domestic Violence Act in 2001 and amendments to the Sexual Offenses Act in 1998 and 1992 were the most recent legislation as of the writing of the addendum. Secondary school enrollment for the 2011 to 2012 school year was slightly higher for males. So it was 51% for males versus 49% for females. And the number of women in tertiary level education is higher than the number of males. So that's 63% for women versus 38% for men. Lastly, Dominica's parliament has more male than female members. The graph that you can see on the right shows that the number of women legislators was 25% as of 2019. With regard to project-specific impacts on gender, during construction and operation, the project will likely affect men and women differently, as the type of employment opportunities provided by the project are more likely to be directed towards men. Some of the mitigation measures that we propose as part of the addendum include continuing engagement with women, continuing the implementation of a grievance mechanism, some target employment goals for women, and non-discrimination and gender-based violence policies. So as you can see on the table to the right, the impact pre-mitigation and post-mitigation goes from moderate to minor after the implementation of the mitigation measures. So next we looked at worker influx. Dominica has been ranked among the top 5 countries in the world that have the highest rates of net migration, although in recent years these rates have decreased. The top 5 countries by origin of immigration include Guadeloupe, the US, the UK, Antigua and Barbuda, and Trinidad and Tobago. The top five countries by origin of migration destination include the U.S., the U.S. Virgin Islands, France, the U.K., and Antigua and Barbuda. The graph on the right shows population by age, sex, and origin based on the based on UNICEF's Dominica migration profile for 2013. So with regard to worker influx impacts, during construction and operations, there will be up to 120 workers at the power plant site and 10 to 15 at the pipeline. These workers are likely to be sourced from outside of Dominica, depending on the selection of the final engineering, procurement, and construction contractor. But the total could also be slightly larger at times if more locals are required to support with construction equipment at difficult locations. A workers' camp is also proposed on site to house up to 50 workers during the construction phase. So in order to mitigate these impacts, the addendum includes some measures such as a security management plan, a community grievance mechanism, a local hiring and supplier plan, a socioeconomic and community health and management plan, workers' accommodation plan and checklist, a code of conduct, and vocational training for local communities. So after mitigation measures, this impact will be reduced from moderate to minor significance. With regard to land acquisition, the addendum covers the new reinjection pipeline route that will affect 12 plots, which are shown on the map to the right. Eight of these plots will be partially acquired, and some include secondary forest and abandoned agriculture. Four of the plots will be fully acquired, and one of these has some active subsistence farming. There will be no physical displacement as part of the reinjection pipeline route. So during construction and operations, land acquisition impacts will consist in some economic displacement because of that active subsistence farming. The project's updated resettlement action plan, or RAP, includes detailed steps to identify, address, and mitigate these impacts. It also includes compensation measures for project-affected parties. The RAP will be discussed in detail later in the presentation. So for land acquisition after mitigation measures, the impact will go from moderate to minor in significance. So lastly, for the impact section of the addendum, we evaluated potential cumulative impacts following the IFC's methodology. So cumulative impacts take into account other projects that might overlap either temporarily or spatially with a project. The main cumulative impacts that we identified were terrestrial and aquatic biota and landscape aesthetics. The development and implementation of a multi-stakeholder collaborative management framework to the extent possible is recommended. DGDC can foster this type of collaboration by participating in working groups and our industry organizations aimed at addressing management of potential impacts. Some examples of these types of initiatives can be promoting the creation and maintenance of green spaces around the project, promoting the use of colors for project components that blend into natural surroundings, promoting information sharing related to impacts from the project to enrich common information and identify potential synergies related to information gathering and mitigation measures, and evaluating opportunities to use shared access roads with other projects. So next, as part of the addendum, we developed management plans. These are included in Appendix A to the addendum and are divided into environmental and social management plans. So on the left, you can see the environmental plans, which include management plans for biodiversity, erosion and sediment control, waste, water, air emissions, noise, well blowouts, disaster risk and emergency, and emergency response. With regard to the social management plans, these include community health and safety, contractors management, COVID-19, external and internal grievance mechanisms, local hiring and suppliers, chance finding procedures, occupational health and safety, security, stakeholder engagement, transportation, and training management plans. So one of these management plans was for the grievance mechanism. So as part of the addendum, we reviewed DGDC's grievance mechanism. We ensured that the community and internal workers' grievance mechanisms will be available and that these will provide a framework through which to ask questions, raise suggestions, or file complaints, and that protection from retaliation and confidentiality are guaranteed. DGDC will ensure that the mechanisms follow the IFC's universal principles as outlined in the figure to the right. These principles include proportionality, cultural appropriateness, accessibility, transparency and accountability, and appropriate protections. In order to ensure the proper implementation of the grievance mechanisms and the resolution of any feedback received, the mechanism is divided into four main steps. These are the reception and registration step, review, analysis and investigation, resolution, and finally, evaluation and follow-up. Questions, suggestions, or complaints will be submitted through the following reception channels. So feedback collected by community liaison officers or managers and DGGC's website, telephone and email, community relations office, a grievance mailbox placed within the project's facilities. The mailbox's precise location will be shared with workers during their hiring process, and a grievances mailbox placed at the project's community relations office. The mailbox's precise location will also be shared with the community during public consultations and other disclosure of information events. So lastly, the addendum also included an update to the resettlement action plan. The updated RAP provides socioeconomic context for the land acquisition process and identifies project impacts. As we discussed previously, there will be 12 plots that will be acquired for the reinjection well and pipeline, consisting of 8 partial acquisitions and 4 full acquisitions. There's a total of 22 plots that will be acquired for the entire project, so that encompasses the power plant, backup production well, and exploratory wells, in addition to the ones that we've discussed for the reinjection well and pipeline. There are instances of subsistence farming, as we've discussed, and there will be one instance of physical displacement, but this is not for the reinjection pipeline. So in order to determine impacts, eligibility and entitlement are assessed, and the RAP provides a structure for the valuation and compensation of land, crops, trees, livestock, and assets. It also includes sections on vulnerability assistance, stakeholder engagement, resettlement sites, like you can see on the photo to the right, roles and responsibilities, grievance management, livelihood restoration, monitoring, and evaluation, budget, and schedule. In accordance with the World Bank Group and IFC policies, engagement and consultation on the RAP have included a socioeconomic census survey that was conducted in 2017 and 2018, consultation with project-affected parties and relevant government institutions such as the Department of Lands and Surveys, presentation of the findings of the RAP to the affected communities in 2018, consultations with the new project-affected parties in 2020, and updated census information for those previously interviewed. Any comments on the RAP from the community or relevant institutions will be incorporated into a final RAP, and it will be updated as necessary with any new information from consultations with community or relevant institutions. Concerns or grievances related to the RAP can go through the grievance mechanism. And lastly, it's important to mention that a recurring concern of project-affected parties was that they would be fairly compensated for their lands in a timely manner, and DGGC continues to present the issue of timely acquisitions and compensation to the Ministry of Lands. So that marks the end of our presentation. Thank you very much for your time and attention, and we can now open up the floor for questions again.
Now, Sonia, can you unshare your screen so we can? Thank you. Any questions? Remember, if you don't feel like you want to talk about the comment, you can also submit the comments to the website, and we will provide responses to those comments in the updated environmental impact assessment and consider the comment.
May I?
Sure, sure. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, good morning.
Good morning.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but Sonia has just mentioned acquisition of properties and seems to be suggesting that some of those properties acquired will be for exploratory wells as well. So I'm wondering, are there going to be more exploratory wells drilled? If so, how many are they planning to drill? And if we're still drilling exploratory wells, does that indicate that we are at this point without adequate resource for actual operations? I also would like the question of employees to be addressed, because I believe she indicated in her submission that the persons employed both for the main operations, 120 persons, and the 10 to 15 on the pipelines would be employed from outside of Dominica. I'm wondering whether the company or the government or whoever is responsible has any intentions at all of putting into place means by which to train Dominicans to be able to operate this system largely with Dominican labor.
Thank you. Thank you, Ella. Herbert, I'd like to take those two questions, please.
Yes, please go ahead.
So two very good questions, and thanks for catching those. Let's start with the, is it exploratory wells, and you're asking, do we have enough resource? Why do we need exploratory wells? Is that a good summary of the question?
I intended to ask earlier how many of the wells already drilled are actually of sufficient
capacity.
So it's a good follow-up.
We currently have 5 wells drilled in the Rosa Valley. If you know the Loda balancing tank, Domlex balancing tank in Loda, right opposite, literally across the street from that, we have 2 wells there. One is the main production well. It's a full-size well. And one is an exploratory well, which we drilled years ago. They're in the same pad, right next to each other. The production well itself, we tested it in 2019, and it has been confirmed to be able to produce more than the 10 megawatts we need. So I want to just get that out there, that we already have in place the steam needed for the 10 megawatts. The design we have for the plant, because the 2 wells are on the same pad and they are both very good wells, we're going to feed steam from both of them into the 10 megawatt plant. So there are no additional exploratory wells required for the domestic facility. And that's a very important point, because that's one of the first questions the lenders ask in financing this project. Do you have the resource for it? The second part to that is the resource itself, the reservoir. What can it support? And that is a question with two answers to it, or two parts to the answer. The first one is, because of all of the studies which have been done over the last decade and the 3 exploratory wells which we have drilled, we have confirmed that, as the scientists say, with over 90% confidence, that the reservoir can today produce about 26 megawatts of electricity, confirmed. This year, we are going to be doing more of those studies, just surface measurements, no drilling for that, to broaden the confidence, because the 26 is sort of the minimum confirmed to date, but they've all, with lower confidence, put the number much, much higher, which is why there's an export phase to this. So I want to just make sure we took care of that question. Now let's move to the employees.
Fred, before you move to the other part of the question,
yes, I
asked a question earlier on about the 2 wells you're going to drill.
Mm-hmm.
And the response I got in the chat is that one is a reinjection well, and the other one is a backup right. production where.
Right.
So could you elaborate on that?
Sure. So as I said, so the two wells I mentioned, which are right opposite the balancing tank, those are going to feed to the turbines. After the steam and the brine leave the turbines, we're going to, luckily, the power plant is at a higher elevation than the rejection wells. So no pumping required. It's just going to flow from the power plant 1 kilometer down to the reinjection well. That well needs to get drilled now. So that's sort of the reinjection well. It's a must for the project. The backup production well is something we're doing with the future in mind. And it's really an economic decision right now, because to bring a drilling rig from very far away to Dominica, not just Dominica, to Loda, is extremely expensive. So we have worked with our financing partners to do this backup production well while the rig is here. That will save us millions of dollars in cost in the future. So I hope that answers that question. I want to go back to the question of employees, because it's a very important question. And I think that I want to clarify what came across in the presentation. Two things. One, if I tell you the reference to housing 50 workers on site, I think that really meant maybe office facilities for 50 workers on site. But we do not plan any camps, any residential camps in Loda. So in fact, you will see some activity from DGDC where we're asking for housing, people who have housing facilities available to register, so that basically we can provide that list to those who are asking as to accommodation that's available in Dominica. So there's no residential accommodation planned on the site. Just want to make sure that's clear. And the comment of 120 workers sourced from outside, that needs to be corrected. That is not the case. Obviously, the technical experts who are technical expertise, which we don't have here, will be brought in. We do not control who the EPC contractor brings in, but it's in their interest, and by interest, I mean economic interest, to hire local workers, and everyone who is involved in this process, that's their intention. They have been in touch with local contractors. So the 120 workers at peak, that is not going to be imported. A percentage will be, but a lot of that is actually going to be local labor. So I want to just make sure that was clear.
Yeah. Fred, I also meant to ask a similar question. That point really caught my attention as well.
Yeah.
Was any baseline done in terms of what is the available skills that exist now? What training has been done by the State College, and is there any relationship between the company and the State College to ensure that they produce, or at least they have the capacity to produce, the type of personnel that you could probably use on the project in the future?
Well, the answer is discussions have been had, unless I'm mistaken. Okay, Alan. Yes, okay. With the college, in terms of the skills availability on the island, that is the part two of what's going on right now with the accommodation. So we actually have a sign-up sheet that's available where people can register their interest to work in the project, to work on the project, especially at this in the months ahead when we are going to be doing a lot of construction work. So both of those are in progress right now. Anyone can register. Again, DGDC is not the one who is going to be hiring these people, but the contractors who are going to be doing the work, they're actually looking for skills. They are looking to find what's available in Dominica. So if there's any interest out there, please contact us, and you sign up and we'll pass on that information to the contractors.
That's a point of clarification in terms mm-hmm. of the scope of the ASIA. And did it just take into account the construction impact? Was any attention given to operational impact as well?
I will let Herbert answer that.
Oh, yeah. I don't know if you see the slide, but I mean, it covers the construction and operation of the project. Yes, both impacts are taken into account. Yes.
Okay, thanks.
Do we have any information in terms of who the partners are in this project, or who the intended partners will be? Because we seem to have gotten no information on that from the discussions between the PM and the ambassador. Is there any information you can give us on that?
But if I may, I think that's deliberate, sir. Not for any nefarious reasons, but simply because negotiations are in progress and the partners themselves do not wish to make any public announcements at this time. So part of the agreements, with them is no public announcements without their consent. So give it a little time. But I think Ambassador Henderson mentioned it, but apart from the banks, the international banks, I mean, they were sort of obvious. If you look at the presentation carefully, you'll have seen the names. But the development partners on this is a consortium of French companies. Very well known, very large, very... Basically, they fit the criteria we mentioned when we said we're doing this with experts. But in terms of names, we are sort of constrained for now.
And be assured that they will be French partners.
Those are the ones that we are working with right now, yeah. And there's also some synergy to that, some strategic reasons for that as well. Because, as I said, this project is not just about 10 megawatts. So.
I don't want to be laborious here, but is there, in light of the revelations in relation to, for example, the question asked of you in relation to the State College, I would assume that the State College would not have the technical know-how to train persons up to standards that are necessary to run such a plant. Would it not be prudent for the authorities to have persons trained in that sort of technology as part of scholarships? Is there any intention of going that way so as to ensure that our locals who wish to have that opportunity can, in fact, have that opportunity? Just a question and suggestion, I guess.
Okay, noted. And I don't really speak for, I mean, I speak for DGDC, so, but what I will tell you is training of Dominicans in the geothermal field has been going on for years. And in fact, I'm looking across the table at one of them right now. So yes, I point noted, but it really has been happening. I'm not sure to what extent you're thinking of, but I just want to point that out, yes.
Any other questions? Like I said before, I mean, you can still submit in writing your questions if you have questions. If you think about something else, we definitely will like to have comments, and we will incorporate those comments and suggestions to the final environmental impact assessment. So thank you very much. Anybody else have any questions?
Okay, we'll be done. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Sonia, Fred, thank you very much. I want to thank everybody for attending this consultation. Your comments and your questions mean a lot to us. So please don't hesitate to contact us. You can reach us at www.geodominica.dm and our office is on 18 Kennedy Avenue, Rosa Dominica. Our office number is 1-767-448-6178. Or you could call me, Alan Toussaint, Community Liaison Officer at 275-7392. Once again, thank you for your time and your participation. Remember, contact us. Stay safe. Thank you very much, Pierre.
Thank you.
Thank you.